This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Anything is Possible by Elizabeth Strout. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. The Sign. Tommy Guptill had once owned a dairy farm, which he'd inherited from his father, and which was about 2 miles from the town of Amgash, Illinois. This was many years ago now. But at night, Tommy still sometimes woke with the fear he had felt the night his dairy farm burned to the ground. The house had burned to the ground as well. The wind had sent sparks onto the house, which was not far from the barns. It had been his fault. He always thought it was his fault. Because he had not checked that night on the milking machines to make sure they had been turned off properly. And this is where the fire started. Once it started, it ripped with a fury over the whole place. They lost everything, except for the brass frame to the living room mirror, which he came upon in the rubble the next day, and he left it where it was. A collection was taken up. For a number of weeks, his kids went to school in the clothes of their classmates, until he could gather himself and the little money he had. He sold the land to the neighboring farmer, but it did not bring much money in. Then he and his wife, a short, pretty woman named Shirley, bought new clothes, and he bought a house as well, Shirley keeping her spirits up admirably as all this was going on. They'd had to buy a house in Amgash, which was a run-down town, and his kids went to school there instead of in Carlisle, where they had been able to go to school before, his farm being just on the line dividing the two towns. Tommy took a job as the janitor in the Amgash school system. The steadiness of the job appealed to him, and he could never go to work on someone else's farm. He did not have the stomach for that. He was 35 years old at the time. The kids were grown now, with kids of their own who were also grown, and he and Shirley still lived in their small house. She had planted flowers around it, which was unusual in that town. Tommy had worried a good deal about his children at the time of the fire. They had gone from having their home be a place that class trips came to. Each year in spring, the fifth grade class from Carlisle would make a day of it, eating their lunches out beside the barns on the wooden tables there. Then tromping through the barns, watching the men milking the cows, the white foamy stuff going up and over them in the clear plastic pipes, to having to see their father as the man who pushed the broom over the magic dust that got tossed over the throw-up of some kid who had been sick in the hallways, Tommy wearing his gray pants and a white shirt that had Tommy stitched on it in red. Well, they had all lived through it. This morning, Tommy drove slowly to the town of Carlisle for errands. It was a sunny Saturday in May, and his wife's 82nd birthday was just a few days away. All around him were open fields, the corn newly planted, and the soybeans, too. A number of fields were still brown, as they'd been plowed under for their planting. But mostly there was the high blue sky, with a few white clouds scattered near the horizon. He drove past the sign on the road that led down to the Barton home. It still said, "Sewing and Alterations," even though the woman, Lydia Barton, who did the sewing and alterations, had died many years ago. The Barton family had been outcasts, even in a town like Amgash. Their extreme poverty and strangeness making this so. The oldest child, a man named Pete, lived alone there now. The middle child was two towns away, and the youngest, Lucy Barton, had fled many years ago and had ended up living in New York City. Tommy had spent time thinking of Lucy. All those years she had lingered after school, alone in a classroom, from fourth grade right up to her senior year in high school. It had taken her a few years to even look him in the eye. But now Tommy was driving past the area where his farm had been. These days it was all fields. Not a sign of the farm was left. And he thought, as he often thought, about his life back then. It had been a good life. But he did not regret the things that had happened. It was not Tommy's nature to regret things. And on the night of the fire, in the midst of his galloping fear, he understood that all that mattered in this world were his wife and his children. And he thought that people lived their whole lives not knowing this as sharply and constantly as he did. Privately, he thought of the fire as a sign from God to keep this gift tightly to him. Privately, because he did not want to be thought of as a man who made up excuses for a tragedy. And he did not want anyone, not even his dearly beloved wife, to think he would do this. But he had felt that night, while his wife kept the children over by the road. He had rushed them from the house when he saw that the barn was on fire. As he watched the enormous flames flying into the nighttime sky, then heard the terrible screaming sounds of the cows as they died. He had felt many things. It was just as the roof of his house crashed in, fell into the house itself, right into their bedrooms and the living room below with all the photos of the children and his parents. As he saw this happen, he had felt undeniably what he could only think was the presence of God. And he understood why angels had always been portrayed as having wings. Because there had been a sensation of that, of a rushing sound, or not even a sound. And then it was as though God, who had no face but was God, pressed up against him and conveyed to him without words, so briefly, so fleetingly, some message that Tommy understood to be, "It's all right, Tommy." And then Tommy had understood that it was all right. It was beyond his understanding, but it was all right. And it had been. He often thought that his children had become more compassionate as a result of having to go to school with kids who were poor and not from homes like the one they had first known. He had felt the presence of God since, at times, as though a golden color was very near to him. But he never again felt visited by God as he had felt that night. And he knew too well what people would make of it, and this is why he would keep it to himself until his dying day, the sign from God. Still, on a spring morning, as this one was, the smell of the soil brought back to him the smells of the cows, the moisture of their nostrils, the warmth of their bellies, and his barns. He had had two barns. And he let his mind roll over pieces of scenes that came to him. Perhaps because he had just passed the Barton place, he thought of the man, Ken Barton, who had been the father of those poor, sad children. and who had worked on and off for Tommy. And then he thought, as he more often did, of Lucy, who had left for college and then ended up in New York City. She had become a writer. Lucy Barton. Driving, Tommy shook his head slightly. Tommy knew many things as a result of being the janitor in that school more than 30 years. He knew of girls' pregnancies and drunken mothers and cheating spouses, for he overheard these things talked about by the students in their small huddles by the bathrooms or near the cafeteria. In many ways, he was invisible. He understood that. But Lucy Barton had troubled him the most. She and her sister, Vicky, and her brother, Pete, had been viciously scorned by the other kids, and by some of the teachers, too. Yet because Lucy stayed after school so often for so many years, he felt, though she seldom spoke, that he knew her the best. One time when she was in the fourth grade, it was his first year working there. He had opened the door to a classroom and found her lying on three chairs pushed together, over near the radiators, her coat as a blanket, fast asleep. He had stared at her, watching her chest move slightly up and down, seen the dark circles beneath her eyes. Her eyelashes spread like tiny twinkling stars, for her eyelids had been moist, as though she had been weeping before she slept. And then he backed out slowly, quietly as he could. It had felt almost unseemly to come upon her like that. But one time, he remembered this now, she must have been in junior high school, and he'd walked into the classroom and she was drawing on the blackboard with chalk. She stopped as soon as he stepped inside the room. "You go ahead," he said. On the board was a drawing of a vine with many small leaves. Lucy moved away from the blackboard. Then she suddenly spoke to him. "I broke the chalk," she said. Tommy told her that was fine. "I did it on purpose," she said. And there was a tiny glint of a smile before she looked away. "On purpose?" he asked. And she nodded, again with the tiny smile. So he went and picked up a piece of chalk, a full stick of it, and he snapped it in half and winked at her. In his memory, she had almost giggled. "You drew that?" he asked, pointing to the vine with the small leaves. And she shrugged then and turned away. But usually she was just sitting at a desk and reading or doing her homework. He could see that she was doing that. He pulled up to a stop sign now and said the words aloud to himself quietly. "Lucy, Lucy, Lucy B. Where did you go to? How did you flee?" He knew how. In the spring of her senior year, he had seen her in the hallway after school, and she had said to him, so suddenly open-faced, her eyes big, "Mr. Guptill, I'm going to college." And he had said, "Oh, Lucy, that's wonderful." She had thrown her arms around him. She would not let go. And so he hugged her back. He always remembered that hug because she had been so thin. He could feel her bones and her small breasts. And because he wondered later how much, how little, that girl had ever been hugged. Tommy pulled away from the stop sign and drove into the town. Right there, beyond, was a parking space. Tommy pulled into it, got out of his car, and squinted in the sunshine.
"Tommy Guptill!"
shouted a man, and turning, Tommy saw Griff Johnson walking toward him with his characteristic limp, for Griff had one leg that was shorter than the other, and even his built-up shoe could not keep him from limping. Griff had an arm out, ready to shake hands.
"Griffith," said Tommy,
and they pumped their arms for a long time while cars drove slowly past them down Main Street. Griff was the insurance man here in town, and he had been awfully good to Tommy. Learning that Tommy had not insured his farm for its worth, Griff had said,
"I met you too late,"
which was true. But Griff, with his warm face and big belly now, continued to be good to Tommy. In fact, Tommy did not know anyone, he thought, who was not good to him. As a breeze moved around them, they spoke of their children and grandchildren. Griff had a grandson who was on drugs, which Tommy thought was very sad, and he just listened and nodded, glancing up at the trees that lined Main Street, their leaves so young and bright green. And then he listened about another grandson who was in medical school now, and Tommy said,
"Hey, that's just great. Good for him."
And they clapped hands on each other's shoulders and moved on. In the dress shop, with its bell that announced his entrance, was Marilyn McCauley, trying on a dress.
"Tommy, what brings you in here?"
Marilyn was thinking of getting the dress for her granddaughter's baptism a few Sundays from now, she said, and she tugged on the side of it. It was beige with swirling red roses. She was without her shoes, standing in just her stockings. She said that it was an extravagance to buy a new dress for such a thing, but that she felt like it. Tommy, who had known Marilyn for years, first when she was in high school as a student in Amgash, saw her embarrassment, and he said he didn't think it was an extravagance at all. Then he said,
"When you have a chance, Marilyn, can you help me find something for my wife?"
He saw her become efficient then, and she said, yes, she certainly would. And she went into the changing room and came back out in her regular clothes, a black skirt and a blue sweater, with her flat black shoes on. And right away, she took Tommy over to the scarves.
"Here,"
she said, pulling out a red scarf that had a design with gold threads running through it. Tommy held it, but picked up a flowery scarf with his other hand.
"Maybe this," he said.
And Marilyn said, "Yes, that looks like Shirley." And then Tommy understood that Marilyn liked the red scarf herself, but would never allow herself to buy it. Marilyn, that first year Tommy worked as a janitor, had been a lovely girl, saying, "Hi, Mr. Guptill," whenever she saw him. And now she had become an older woman, nervous, thin, her face pinched. Tommy thought what other people thought. It was because her husband had been in Vietnam and had never afterward been the same. Tommy would see Charlie McCauley around town, and he always looked so far away, the poor man. And poor Marilyn, too. So Tommy held the red scarf with the gold threads for a minute as though considering it, then said,
"I think you're right. This one looks more like Shirley."
And took the flowery one to the register. He thanked Marilyn for her help.
"I think she'll love it," Marilyn said.
And Tommy said he was sure she would. Back on the sidewalk, Tommy walked up to the bookstore. He thought there might be a gardening book his wife would like. Once he was inside, he walked about, then saw, right there in the middle of the store, a display of a new Lucy Barton book. He picked it up. It had on its cover a city building. Then he looked at the back flap where her picture was. He thought he wouldn't recognize her if he met her now. It was only because he knew it was her that he could see the remnants of her in her smile, still a shy smile. He was reminded once again of the afternoon she said she had broken the chalk on purpose, her funny little smile that day. She was an older woman now, and the photo showed her hair pulled back, and the more he looked at it, the more he could see the girl she had been. Tommy moved out of the way of a mother with two small children. She moved past him with the kids and said, "Excuse me, sorry." And he said, "Oh, sure." And then he wondered, as he sometimes did, what Lucy's life had been like so far away in the city of New York. He put the book back on the display and went to find the sales clerk to ask about a book on gardening.
"I might have just the thing. We just got this in."
And the girl, who was not a girl, really, except they all seemed like girls to Tommy these days, brought him a book with hyacinths on the cover. And he said, "Oh, that's perfect." The girl asked if he wanted it wrapped. And he said, "Yes, that would be great." And he watched while she spread the silver paper around it, with her fingernails that were painted blue, and with her tongue sticking slightly out between her teeth as she concentrated. She put the scotch tape on, then gave him a big smile when it was done. "That's perfect," he repeated. And she said, "You have a nice day now." And he told her the same. He left the store and walked across the street in the bright sunshine. He would tell Shirley about Lucy's book. She had loved Lucy because he had. Then he started the car and pulled out of the parking space, started back down the road toward home. The Johnson boy came to Tommy's mind, how he couldn't get off drugs. And then Tommy thought of Marilyn McCauley and her husband, Charlie. And then his mind went to his older brother, who had died a few years back. And he thought how his brother, who had been in World War II, who had been at the camps when they were being emptied. He thought how his brother had returned from the war a different man. His marriage ended. His children disliked him. Not long before his brother died, he told Tommy about what he had seen in the camps, and how he and the others had the job of taking the townspeople through them. They had somehow taken a group of women from the town through the camps to show them what had been right there. And Tommy's brother said that although some of the women wept, some of them put their chins up and looked angry, as if they refused to be made to feel bad. This image had always stayed with Tommy, and he wondered why it came to him now. He unrolled the window all the way down. It seemed the older he grew, and he had grown old, the more he understood that he could not understand this confusing contest between good and evil, and that maybe people were not meant to understand things here on earth. But as he approached the sign that declared sowing and alterations, he slowed his car and turned down the long road that led to the Barton house. Tommy had made a practice of checking in on Pete Barton, who, of course, was not a kid now, but an older man, ever since Ken, Pete's father, had died. Pete had stayed living in the house alone, and Tommy had not seen him for a couple of months. down the long road he drove. It was isolated out here, a thing he and Shirley had discussed over the years, isolation not being a good thing for the kids. There were cornfields on one side and soybean fields on the other. The single tree, huge, that had been in the middle of the cornfields, had been struck by lightning a few years back, and it lay now on its side, the long branches bare and broken and poking up toward the sky. The truck was there, next to the small house, which had not been painted in so many years it looked washed out, the shingles pale, some missing. The blinds were drawn, as they always were, and Tommy got out of his car and went and knocked on the door. Standing in the sunshine, he thought again of Lucy Barton, how she had been a skinny child, painfully so, and her hair was long and blonde, and almost never did she look him in the eye. Once, when she was still so young, he had walked into a classroom after school and found her sitting there reading, and she had jumped. He saw her really jump with fear when the door opened. He had said to her quickly, "No, no, you're fine." But it was that day, seeing the way she jumped, seeing the terror that crossed her face, when he guessed that she must have been beaten at home. She would have to have been, in order to be so scared at the opening of a door. After he realized this, he took more notice of her, and there were days he saw what seemed to be a bruise, yellow or bluish, on her neck or her arms. He told his wife about it, and Shirley said, "What should we do, Tommy?" And he thought about it, and she thought about it, and they decided they would do nothing. But the day they discussed this was the day Tommy told his wife what he had seen Ken Barton, Lucy's father, do years before, when Tommy had his dairy farm and Ken worked on the machinery at times. Tommy had walked out behind one of the barns and seen Ken Barton, with his pants down by his ankles, pulling on himself, swearing. What a thing to have come upon! Tommy said, "None of that out here, Ken." And the man turned around and got into his truck and drove off, and he did not return to work for a week. "Tommy, why didn't you tell me this?" Shirley's blue eyes looked up at him with horror. And Tommy said it seemed too awful to repeat. "Tommy, we need to do something," his wife said that day. And they talked about it more and decided once again there was nothing they could do. The blind moved slightly, and then the door opened, and Pete Barton stood there. "Hello, Tommy," he said. Pete stepped outside into the sunshine, closing the door behind him, and stood next to Tommy, and Tommy understood that Pete didn't want him inside the house. Already a rank odor came to Tommy, maybe coming off Pete himself. "Just driving by, and I thought I'd see how you were doing." Tommy said this casually. "Thanks, I'm okay. Thank you." In the bright sun, Pete's face looked pale, and his hair was almost all gray now. But it was a pale gray, and it seemed to match the pale shingles of the house he stood in front of.
"You're working over at the Dar place?" Tommy asked.
Pete said he was, though that job was almost done, but he had another lined up in Hanston.
"Good."
Tommy squinted toward the horizon, all soybean fields in front of him, the bright green of them showing in the brown soil. Right on the horizon was the barn of the Peterson place. They spoke of different machines then, and also of the wind turbines that had been put up recently between Carlisle and Hanston.
"We've just got to get used to them, I guess," said Tommy.
And Pete said he guessed Tommy was right about that. The one tree that stood next to the driveway had its little leaves out, and the branches dipped for a moment in the wind. Pete leaned against Tommy's car, his arms folded across his chest. He was a tall man, but his chest seemed almost concave. He was that thin.
"Were you in the war, Tommy?"
Tommy was surprised at the question.
"No," he said. "No, I was too young. Just missed it. My older brother was, though."
Up and down quickly once went the branches of the tree, as though it had felt a breeze that Tommy had not.
"Where was he?"
Tommy hesitated. Then he said,
"He was assigned to the camps at the end of the war. He was in the corps that went to the camps in Buchenwald."
Tommy looked up at the sky, reached into his pocket, pulled out his sunglasses, and slipped them onto his face.
"He was changed after that. I can't say how, but he was changed."
He walked over and leaned against his car next to Pete. After a moment, Pete Barton turned toward Tommy. In a voice without belligerence, even with a touch of apology to it, he said,
"Look, Tommy, I'd like it if you didn't keep coming over here."
Pete's lips were pale and cracked, and he wet them with his tongue, looking at the ground. For a moment, Tommy was not sure he heard right. But as he started to say,
"I only,"
Pete looked at him fleetingly and said,
"You do it to torture me, and I think enough time has gone by now."
Tommy pushed himself away from the car and stood straight, looking through his sunglasses at Pete.
"Torture you?" Tommy asked. "Pete, I'm not here to torture you."
A sudden small gust of wind blew up the road then, and the dirt they stood on swirled a tiny bit. Tommy took his sunglasses off so that Pete could see his eyes. He looked at him with great concern.
"Forget I said that. I'm sorry."
Pete's head ducked down.
"I just like to check on you every so often," Tommy said. "You know, neighbor to neighbor. You live here all alone. Seems to me a neighbor should check in once in a while."
Pete looked at Tommy with a wry smile and said,
"Well, you're the only man who ever does that, or woman."
Pete laughed. It was an uncomfortable sound. They stood, the two of them, Tommy's arms unfolded now. He slipped his hands into his pockets, and Pete slipped his hands into his pockets as well. Pete kicked at a stone, then turned to look out over the field.
"The Petersons should take that tree away. I don't know why they don't. It was one thing to plow around it when it was standing up straight, but now, sheesh!"
"They're going to," I heard them talking. Tommy did not quite know what to do, and this was an odd feeling for him. Still looking toward the toppled tree, Pete said,
"My father was in the war. He got all screwed up."
Now Pete turned and looked at Tommy, his eyes squinting in the sunshine.
"When he was dying, he told me about it. It was terrible. What happened to him? And then he shot these two German guys. He knew they weren't soldiers. They were almost kids. But he told me he felt every day of his life that he should have killed himself in return.
Tommy listened to this, looking at the boy, the man, without his sunglasses, which he held in his hand in his pocket.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't know your father was in the war.
My father! And here, Pete unmistakably had tears in his eyes.
My father was a decent man, Tommy.
Tommy nodded slowly.
He did things because he couldn't control himself, and so he...
Pete turned away. In a moment, he turned partway back to Tommy and said,
And so he went in and turned on those milking machines that night. And then the place burned down, and I never, ever forgot it, Tommy. It was like I knew he had done it. And I know you know that, too.
Tommy felt his scalp break out into goosebumps. It continued. He felt the bumps crawling across his head. The sun seemed very bright, and yet it seemed it shone in a cone around only him. In a moment, he said,
Son, the word came out involuntarily, you mustn't think that.
Look, Pete said, and his face had some color to it now.
He knew the milking machines could cause trouble. He'd talked about it. He'd said it wasn't a very sophisticated system and they could get overheated in a hurry.
Tommy said,
He was right about that.
He was mad at you.
He was always mad at someone, but he was mad at you. I don't know what happened, but he was working at your place and then he stopped. I think he went back eventually, but he never liked you after whatever happened had happened.
Tommy put his sunglasses back on. He said with deliberateness,
I found him playing with himself, Pete, pulling on himself behind the barns. And I said that was something he couldn't do there.
Oh, man. Pete wiped at his nose.
Oh, man.
He looked up at the sky. Then he looked at Tommy quickly and said,
Well, he didn't like you. And the night before the fire, he went out. Sometimes he would just do that, go out. He wasn't a drinker, but sometimes he'd just leave the house and go out. And that night, he went out and he got back around midnight. I remember because my sister couldn't sleep. She was too cold. And my mother...
Here Pete stopped, as though to catch his breath.
Well, my mother was... up with her, and I remember she said, Lucy, go to sleep. It's midnight.
And my father came home, and the next morning when I was at school,
well, we all heard about the fire.
And I just knew. Tommy steadied himself against the car. He said nothing.
And you knew too, Pete finally said. And that's why you stopped by here, to torture me.
For many moments, the two men stood there. The breeze had picked up and Tommy felt it ripple the sleeves of his shirt. Then Pete turned to go back inside the house. The door opened with a squeak.
Pete, Tommy called. Pete, listen to me. I don't come here to torture you, and I still don't know, even with what you just told me, that it's true.
Pete turned back. After a moment, he closed the door behind him and walked back to Tommy. His eyes were moist, either from the wind that was whipping up or from tears. Tommy didn't know. Pete spoke almost tiredly.
I'm just telling you, Tommy. He wasn't supposed to go and do those things in the war that he had to do. People aren't supposed to murder people. And he did. And he did awful things. And awful things happened to him. And he couldn't live inside himself, Tommy. That's what I'm trying to say. Other men could do it, but he couldn't. It ruined him. And what about your mother? Tommy asked suddenly. Pete's face changed. A blankness of expression came to it. What about her? He asked. How did she take all this? Pete seemed defeated by this question. He shook his head slowly. I don't know, he said. I don't know what my mother was like. I never really knew her myself, Tommy said. Just saw her out and about once in a while. But it came to him now. He had never seen the woman smile. Pete was gazing at the ground. He shrugged and said, I don't know about my mother. Tommy's mind, which had been spinning, rearranged itself. He felt himself again. Now listen, Pete. I'm glad you told me about your father being in the war. I heard what you said. You said he was a decent man, and I believe you. But he was! Pete almost wailed this, looking at Tommy with his pale eyes. Whenever he did something, he felt terrible about it later, and after your fire, he was so agitated, Tommy. For weeks and weeks, he was worse than ever. It's okay, Pete. But it's not. But it is. Tommy said this firmly. He walked over to the man and put his hand on Pete's arm for a moment. Then he added, And I don't think he did it, anyway. I think I forgot to turn the machines off that night. And your father was mad at me, and he probably felt bad about what happened. He never told you he did it, am I right? When he was dying and told you about killing those men in the war, he never confessed to burning my barns down, did he? Pete shook his head. Then I suggest you let it go, Pete. You've had enough to contend with. Pete ran a hand over his hair. A piece of it stood up briefly. With some confusion, he said, Contend with? I saw how you were treated by the town, Pete, and your sisters too. I saw that when I was a janitor. Tommy felt slightly winded. Pete gave a small shrug. He still seemed vaguely confused. Okay, he said. Okay, then. They stood a few more moments in the breeze, and then Tommy said he was going to get going. Hold on, said Pete. Let me drive down the road with you. It's time I got rid of that sign of my mother's. I've been meaning to do that, and I'll do it now. Hold on, he said again. Tommy waited by the car while Pete went inside the house, and very soon Pete came back out, holding a sledgehammer. Tommy got in the driver's seat, and Pete got in on the passenger's side, and together they drove down the road. The rank odor Tommy had smelled before was stronger now with the man next to him. As he drove, Tommy suddenly remembered how one time he had put a quarter near the desk where Lucy would sit when she was in junior high school. She always went to Mr. Haley's room. The man taught social studies for a year, then went into the service.
but he must have been kind to Lucy, because that was the room, even when it later became the science room, that Lucy preferred to be in. And so, one day, Tommy left a quarter near the desk he knew she sat at. The school had just gotten a vending machine, and there were ice cream sandwiches you could buy for a quarter. So he left the quarter there where Lucy could see it. That night, after she had gone home, Tommy went into the room, and the quarter was still there, exactly where he had left it. He almost asked Pete, then, about Lucy, if they were in touch. But he had already pulled up next to the sign that said, Sewing and Alterations, and so he just said, Here you go, Pete. You be well. And Pete thanked him and got out of the car. After a few moments, Tommy glanced in his rearview mirror, and what he saw was Pete Barton hitting the sign with the sledgehammer. Something about the way he hit it, the force, made Tommy watch carefully as he drove down the road. He saw the boy, the man, hit the sign again and again with what seemed to be increasing force, and as Tommy's car dipped down just slightly, losing sight for a moment, he thought, wait. And when his car came back up, he looked again in the rearview mirror, and he saw again this boy-man hitting that sign with rage, with a ferocity that astonished Tommy. It was astonishing, the rage with which that man was hitting that sign. It seemed indecent to Tommy that he was witnessing it, for it felt as private in its anguish as what the boy's father had been doing out behind Tommy's barns that day. And then, as Tommy drove, he realized, oh, it was the mother. It was the mother. She must have been the really dangerous one. He slowed the car, then turned it around. As he drove back, he saw that Pete had stopped smashing the sign and was now kicking at the pieces with a tired dejection. Pete looked up, surprise showing on his face, as Tommy approached. Tommy leaned to unroll the passenger's window and said, Pete, get in. The man hesitated, sweat on his face now. Get in, Tommy said again. Pete got back into the car, and Tommy drove down the road, back to the Barton home. He turned the car engine off. Pete, I want you to listen to me very, very carefully. A look of fear passed over Pete's face, and Tommy put his hand briefly on the man's knee. It was the look of terror that had passed over Lucy's face when he surprised her in the classroom. I want to tell you something I had never in my life planned on telling anyone. But on the night of the fire, and Tommy told him then, in detail, how he had felt God come to him, and how God had let Tommy know it was all okay. When he was done, Pete, who had listened intently, sometimes looking down, sometimes looking at Tommy, now looked at Tommy with wonder on his face. So you believe that? Pete asked. I don't believe it, Tommy said. I know it. And you never even told your wife? I never did, no. But why not? I guess there are some things in life we don't tell others. Pete looked down at his hands, and Tommy looked at the man's hands as well. He was surprised by them. They were strong-fingered, large. They were a grown man's hands. So, you're saying my father was doing God's work? Pete shook his head slowly. No,
I'm telling you what happened to me that night. I know. I hear what you're telling me. Pete gazed through the windshield. I just don't know what to make of it.
Tommy looked at the truck that sat next to the house. Its fender glinted in the sunlight. The truck was old and gray-brown. It almost matched the color of the house. It seemed to Tommy that he sat there for many minutes looking at that truck and how it matched the house.
Tell me how Lucy is, said Tommy then, moving his feet, hearing them scrape over the grit on the floor of the car. I saw she's got a new book.
She's good, said Pete, and his face lit up.
She's good, and it's a good book. She sent me an early copy. I'm really proud of her.
Tommy said, you know, she wouldn't even take a quarter I left her once. And he told Pete about leaving the quarter and finding it later.
No, Lucy wouldn't have taken a penny that wasn't hers, Pete said. He added, my sister Vicky, well, she's another story. I bet she would have taken the quarter and then asked for more.
He glanced at Tommy.
Yeah, she'd have taken it. Well, I guess there's always that struggle between what to do and what not to do, Tommy said, attempting to be jocular.
Pete said,
what?
And Tommy repeated it.
That's interesting, said Pete.
And Tommy was struck with a sense of being with a child, not a grown man, and he looked again at Pete's hands. The car engine made a few clicking sounds as they sat in silence.
You asked about my mother, Pete said after a few moments. Nobody has ever asked me about my mother. But the truth is, I don't know if my mother loved us or not. I don't know about her in some big way.
He looked at Tommy, and Tommy nodded.
But my father loved us, Pete said. I know he did. He was troubled. Oh, man, was he troubled. But he loved us.
Tommy nodded his head again.
Tell me more about what you just said, Pete asked.
About what?
What was I just saying?
The struggle, did you say that?
Between doing what we should and what we shouldn't do?
Oh. Tommy looked through the windshield at the house, sitting so silently and so worn out there in the sunshine, its blinds drawn like tired eyelids.
Well, here's an example on a large scale.
And then Tommy told Pete about what his brother had seen in the war, the women who had walked through the camps, how some had wept and others had looked furious and would not be made to feel bad.
And so there's a struggle, or a contest, I guess you could say, all the time, it seems to me. And remorse. Well, to be able to show remorse, to be able to be sorry about what we've done that's hurt other people, that keeps us human.
Tommy put his hand on the steering wheel.
That's what I think, he said. My father showed remorse. He's what you're talking about in one person. The contest.
I suppose you're right. The sun had grown so high in the sky it could not be seen from the car.
I never have talks like this, said Pete.
And Tommy was struck once again by how young this boy man seemed. Tommy experienced a tiny physical pain deep in his chest that seemed directly connected to Pete.
I'm an old man, said Tommy. I think if we're going to have talks like this one, I should stop by more often. How about I see you 2 Saturdays from now?
Tommy was surprised to see Pete's hands become fists that he banged down on his knees.
No, Pete said. No, you don't have to. No. I want to, said Tommy.
And he thought, then he knew, as he said this, that it was not true. But did that matter? It didn't matter.
I don't need someone coming to see me out of obligation.
Pete said this quietly. The pain deep in Tommy's chest increased.
I don't blame you for that, he said.
They sat together in the car, which was now warm, and the smell to Tommy was palpable. In a moment, Pete spoke again.
Well, I guess I thought you were coming here to torture me, and I was wrong about that. So I guess maybe I'd be wrong to think you were just obliging me. I think you'd be wrong, said Tommy.
But he was aware again that this was not true. The truth was that he did not really want to visit this poor boy man seated next to him ever again. They sat in silence for a few moments more. Then Pete turned to Tommy, gave him a nod.
All right, I'll see you then, said Pete, getting out of the car.
Thanks, Tommy, he said. And Tommy said,
thank you.
Driving home, Tommy was aware of a sensation like that of a tire becoming flat, as though he had been filled all his life with some sustaining air, and it was gone now. He felt increasingly as he drove a sense of fear. He could not understand it. But he had told what he had vowed to himself never to tell, that God had come to him the night of the fire. Why had he told? Because he wanted to give something to that poor boy who had been smashing the sign of his mother so ferociously. Why did it matter that he had told the boy? Tommy wasn't sure. But Tommy felt he had pulled the plug on himself, that by telling the thing he would never tell, he had diminished himself past forgiveness. It really frightened him.
So you believe that? Pete Barton had said.
He felt no longer himself. He said quietly,
God, what have I done?
And he meant that he was really asking God. And then he said, where are you, God? But the car remained the same, warm, still slightly smelling from the presence of Pete Barton, just rumbling over the road. He drove more quickly than he usually did. Going past him were the fields of soybeans and corn, and the brown fields as well. And he saw them only barely. At home, Shirley was sitting on the front steps. Her glasses twinkled in the sunlight, and she waved to him as he drove up the small driveway.
Shirley, he called as he got out of the car. Shirley.
She pulled herself up from the steps by holding on to the railing and came to him with worry on her face.
Shirley, he said, I have to tell you about something.
At the small kitchen table, in their small kitchen, they sat. A tall water glass held peony buds, and Shirley pushed it to the side. Tommy told her then what had just happened that morning at the Barton home, and she kept shaking her head, pushing her glasses up her nose with the back of her hand.
Oh, Tommy, she said. Oh, that poor boy. But here's the thing, Shirley. It's more than that. There's something else I need to tell you.
And so Tommy looked at his wife, her blue eyes behind her glasses, a faded blue.